10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The next few minutes of WGTD's morning show are going to be spent with a gentleman by the name of Jim Hock, who has written a wonderful book, actually a couple of different books, about the Los Angeles Rams of the 1950s, a team for which his father, John Hock, played as a member of the offensive line. And the latest of Jim Hock's books is called Father on the Line, a Memoir, in which he focuses very specifically on his father, who was a hard-working, solid, dependable, to some extent unheralded member of this really glamorous team, one of the most exciting teams of its era. And it's a illuminating look at what professional football was like back in the 1950s as it was just starting to come into its own. And in particular, the way in which the game was played and received and celebrated in the colorful city of Los Angeles, which itself was also undergoing something of an exciting transformation. And I'm excited to be able to speak with Jim Hock about this book published by Rare Bird Books, again titled Father on the Line, a Memoir. Jim Hock, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I did not, in that introduction, say anything about the interesting career that you yourself have had. According to your biography, you were chief of staff to a United States Secretary of Commerce. You were a spokesperson for a U.S. senator, the founder of your own communications firm. So you have had quite the active life, which has also included playing plenty of football. But I wonder if you could just start by kind of telling us a little bit more about this interesting professional life that that you have had, and maybe a little bit about what your dad thought of that.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Greg. I'm a marketing communications person by background. I've worked for a senator, Feinstein from California, and worked for a commerce secretary, Penny Pritzker, who I still work for today in an investment firm. But I've had a pretty diverse career. I've always kind of been in and around the policy world, policy/business, but more on the communications and public relations side. And yes, I did have my own communications and marketing firm that I ran for about a decade as well. So I've been an entrepreneur and just blessed. And my dad, unfortunately passed away in 2000, so he saw the beginning of my career, but didn't see, you know, what I've done the last 20 years. But he's, and I'm sure he would be proud, because a lot of the values that I bring to my business life are values that were instilled by my dad and my mom.
I wonder if you would tell our listeners the way your book begins, the introduction, which it begins colorfully enough with a threat from your older brother, Joe. Tell us what the occasion was, what this threat was, and what was behind those interesting words.
That's all right, Greg. So I'm the youngest of seven in a big Irish Catholic family. Even though our name is Hock, we're mostly Irish. So my dad, we had a really big memorial service after he had passed away in Southern California in 2000. And of course, again, being Irish and being Catholic, we had a celebration of life. And afterwards, that turned into kind of a celebration with beers. And we were sitting around a fire pit with a lot of my dad's old teammates, like Les Richter and Andy Robustelli and others. And they were just telling stories about what it was like to play football in the 1950s, sharing stories about our dad. And my brother, I have two brothers, Jay and Joe. Joe's the closest in age to me. But again, being the youngest, I'm the one who always gets kind of the was always picked on even to this day. I'm almost 51. But Joe punches me in the arm at one point and says, "Hey, man, I can't write, but you can. You know, you got to write these stories up for us and for our mom." And so, honestly, the book was only meant really for our family and just, you know, to share with our, you know, all the grandkids. And I have a friend in the book business who read it and, you know, decided that it was, you know, a good quality book, which I was flattered by, and said, "You need to get this published," and found me a publisher and an agent and all that stuff. And I had never written a book before. So, you know, that's how the book started, was a threat from my brother. So I asked if, excuse my French, if I didn't write it.
It took you a long time. I was trying to kind of do the math in terms of just how many years you ended up laboring. I think maybe you started it, put it aside, picked it up again, but we're talking about many years. I mean, your dad died in 2000. I think you started work on it in 2002. I mean, just tell us a little bit about the gestation of this book and why, in a sense, it came into being in fits and starts the way that it did.
Yeah, it's a great question. So my oldest was born in 2002, and so, you know, the reflection of, like, losing my dad 2 years prior and then having a son 2 years, you know, after, and just, you know, trying to reconcile, as we all will either, you know, have lost a parent or will lose a parent, you know, just a circle of life thing. I was dealing with, you know, how to deal with the grief of losing a parent. I was, you know, in my early 30s, just about 30, 31 at the time, and started the book in 2002 by really just, like I said, just conversations with my dad's friends, Andy Robustelli, Frank Gifford, Les Richter, you know, a whole bunch of you know, great players and from the 50s. And I was, you know, recording the conversations and then just starting to put them together, just like kind of in a series of, you know, papers for my family. So I just took my time, and then a couple of years into it, I realized, oh, there's a book here, and, you know, the Rams were really an exciting team in the 1950s, and I think other people would be interested in kind of learning that there's some history here as well, and the groundbreaking franchise in a lot of ways. The first team to move west of the Mississippi River, the first team to integrate in the modern era, you know, a year before Jackie Robinson, the first team to have 1 million fans in the seats, the first team with a television contract, first team with a logo on their helmets, so I'm quite upset about the new logo on the Rams helmets. But in many ways, they were the first modern sports franchise, and they were run by a young guy named Pete Rozelle, who was their PR general manager, who just a few short years later, in 1960, became the, you know, what they referred to as the boy commissioner in the NFL at age 33. So he took a lot. Mr. Rozelle took a lot of what he learned with the Rams, and just, you know, innovating in the 50s. Marketing, if you will, and then took those practices to the greater league, and obviously had a national television contract that put the league, you know, where it is today, was with a national, you know, TV rights and TV contract that you know, has made financial health of the league, you know, top notch and the best of all the different sports leagues.
One point that I think is really important for us to make for everybody is that your dad played in the NFL until 1957, when injuries forced him to retire rather early. I mean, he had not played all that long. You were born in 1969, so you never got to see your dad play football. First of all, tell us how much you knew growing up about the fact that your dad had played in the NFL. To what extent would this come up a lot in conversation? I mean, were there trophies around the house? Or, I mean, is this something that you were well aware of, even though you never got to witness it directly?
Yeah, it was definitely part of our family. I mean, we had we were constantly at NFL games. A lot of my dad's friends were coaches, so depending on where we were in our travels, mostly, you know, in Southern California, but also on the East Coast, where I went to middle school and high school, we would see coaches in locker rooms and players, and so I was always around the game. You're right, I never saw my dad. I saw him on film, And the most prominent, you mentioned the unfortunately, the most prominent trophy he had in our family room was a game ball from the Western Division Championship in 1955, where they beat the Green Bay Packers. Sorry for the fans in that area, but that was a big deal for him because, and for my mom as well, because it was for an offensive guard to win a game ball is a big deal, because they usually do the grunt work, but the line in that game had kind of played their tails off.
How frustrating was it for you to not have been around to see him play? I mean, as I read your book, I kept coming back to that for some reason, the fact that you probably would have just desperately wanted to have been around for that, but you just weren't on planet Earth yet. And it was like this exciting thing that, in a sense, you missed, even though, of course, you got to kind of live it in retrospect. But what did it feel like, especially to be a youngster and to know that you had, in a sense, missed out on something so exciting?
That's a fantastic question, Greg. I've done a lot of interviews, and that's the first time I've ever been asked that question. It's really insightful the way you asked that. So what I would say to that is I would have loved to see my dad play. We live in the in Northern Virginia right now, and my wife jokes to me, we have season tickets to the Los Angeles Rams, and we probably won't be going this year, obviously, but I was there for the first game when they came back to Los Angeles, and honestly, I was absolutely overcome with emotion because it was in the Los Angeles Coliseum, obviously, where my dad had played many years before and grown up right, within blocks of walking towards, to the Coliseum. And it was funny because I talked to a friend of mine, Chris Schiavelli, whose dad, Joe Schiavelli, played in the late 50s and the 60s and a much longer career than my dad. But I talked to Chris afterwards and I said, Chris, I hate to admit this, but I was choked up and had tears in my eyes the whole game. And he's like, me too, man. It was so real that, the team was back and you could feel their presence there. And it was a really cool experience. But I wish, I did get to see him play. I saw him on film, as I said, but it's not the same.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Jim Hock, whose father, John Hock, played for the Los Angeles Rams back in the 1950s. And Jim Hock has written a couple of different books about the L.A. Rams of the 1950s, and the most recent focuses more specifically on his own father. The book is titled Father on the Line, A Memoir. Before we talk a little more specifically about your father and who he was, where he came from, and the kind of ball player and human being he was, I wonder if we could talk for a moment about Los Angeles itself. I think one thing that is really interesting about your book, and which very much enriches it, is the fact that Los Angeles is almost as important a character in this story as is your father or any of the superstars that played for the Rams. You obviously have a very powerful sense of connection to the city and also a very keen understanding of all that Los Angeles has been through, and in particular what this city was like in the 1950s, that period of time that you focus on most specifically. First of all, just talk about that decision that you made as the author of this book to make the city of Los Angeles itself such a prominent player.
Exactly. I did try to make LA almost as the city a character in the book. I talked about the growth and the explosion of people moving, from east to the west in LA in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And these are the stories that I was told by my parents, because my parents, my grandparents' generation moved from the Midwest and the East to the West, so they experienced that same transition. My dad had moved when he was 9 years old during the Depression from Pittsburgh to California, and was told by his dad, "Son, I'll see you in a month or so. I'm going out to California." And my dad was like, "What is that? Where is that?" And an older cousin had brought he and my grandmother and his sister at the time out to L.A. But, I'd grown up with a lot of these stories, Greg, so it's just fascinating to me. Here's the second largest city in the country, but back then it was a growing city. It was filled with dynamism. There's some stories in the book about how, you couldn't recognize blocks just a month or two later just because there's so much construction going on and freeway building and what have you. Just to put it in perspective, Disneyland, which was built in 1955, Walt Disney's son-in-law played for the Rams. His name was Ron Miller, a good friend of my dad's. Disneyland went up in less than a year in Anaheim. And so you can imagine, never imagine that happening today. So just the explosion of just things happening, and then also, you know, Hollywood was in its heyday. And so I tried to capture a lot of that in the book. And again, as you said, almost make it a character. Mm-hmm. It's a great way to put it.
At one point you wrote, L.A. Is glamorous and middle class and poor, full of promise, impossible to predict. And I think that's probably true today, and certainly it was true back in the 1950s, as this city that was very energetic transition, and it was certainly not mansions on every block, far from it. But as you said, full of promise, impossible to predict. What an exciting place to be at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I try to do, Greg, too, is, and I saw this on my dad's team, is like they had, you know, some of the most iconic names in NFL history. You know, Elroy Hirsch, who's from there in Wisconsin, was a longtime athletic director at the University of Wisconsin. But people like Elroy Hirsch, Norm Van Brocklin, Bob Waterfield, Tom Fears, Dick Nitrane Lane, Les Richards, these were like who's who Hall of Famers, so the stars. But then on any football team, but in any organization, whether it's a business or a Hollywood set, there's the people that kind of do the hard work behind the scenes that don't get a lot of accolades. And to me, that's the offensive line. And that was my dad, very humble, quiet, just everyday workhorses. But it takes those type of people, to make cities run. And so that's where I talked about the L.A. glamour, but also the middle class and the poor. And just it takes all kinds to make a city, to make an organization run.
You write at one point, like the city itself, what I found most remarkable was that the Rams were comprised of big stars and everyday workhorses like my dad, a quiet, humble, and stout offensive guard that are needed to make things run if any effort is to be successful. And it's really great that you take the time to point that out, because, of course, what we tend to focus on are the big stars, the celebrities, the glamorous face of it, and whether we're talking about a sports franchise or about an overall city, we tend to really neglect to pretty much ignore that other side of it, which is every bit as essential, but which does not tend to generate headlines or find a place in the spotlight.
Exactly. I mean, the quote, in the trenches, right? The teams that are the strongest are the ones that are the strongest in the trenches. Those are the workhorses that get the job done. But we're seeing it in our society today, Greg, right? It's like the nurses, the mail carriers, the postal workers, the the firefighters, the cops. You know, these are the folks that we, unfortunately, take for granted, the people that, care for our kids, teachers. These are essential workers, right? And so the essential workers of a pro football team are the offensive, defensive line. If you're not stout there, you're not going to be a stout team.
Another observation you make about Los Angeles itself that I want to give you a chance to expand upon is when you said Los Angeles became a place where eager, hungry minds looked for problems to solve and where innovation and gimmicks thrived. Not only thrived, but were in demand. And of course, some parallels could probably be drawn between the city itself and that aspect of its character, and the way in which the Los Angeles Rams of the 1950s also reflected that sense of eager innovation. Tell us more about that, beginning with the city itself.
Yeah, the city itself, I mean, it was growing so quickly. Obviously, Hollywood and the dynamism of Hollywood and driving so much of the view of our culture, not only in the United States at the time, but even today, but internationally as well. So, kind of pushing the envelope on various, touch points and cultural touch points, race, class, gender, all those kind of things, asking questions and the creativity. being drawn to there by the different reasons from a culture standpoint. You know, from the Rams' perspective, they were also, they kind of had to reflect. They were a high-flying, you know, passing team. Their head coach, Sid Gilman, who had coached the University of Cincinnati, was an innovator. He was the first coach to ever kind of look at you know, game film. He's known as the architect of the modern passing game because he invented the passing tree. He invented timing patterns, you know, and all these kind of things that we just that are still in use today. But it was Sid Gilman, and one of his innovations that didn't last was he sent the offensive guards in with the plays, you know, rotation. Sometimes they did with the quarterbacks, but one year they did that, and my dad absolutely hated it because he could never get into a flow of games. So that was an innovation that didn't work. But, you know, Disney, I mentioned Disney earlier, Disneyland just exploding, you know, upon the scene in the mid-50s.
I'm glad that you mentioned Disneyland. It just by the funniest of coincidences, yesterday, the day before we're recording this, I watched one of my favorite DVDs, which is of the live telecast of the opening of Disneyland. And, you know, it's this black and white kind of out of focus program and very complicated. There were lots of little glitches in this live telecast, but it was just so exciting. And you really got this sense of the audaciousness of this undertaking and of the marvelous spirit of innovation and optimism that were really at the heart of that project. And but not until really looking at your book and thinking about it did I realize that that was not only a reflection of who Walt Disney was, but also a reflection of what Los Angeles was like at this point in time.
Exactly. No, it was like I had said earlier, they built Disneyland, and believe it or not, 11 or so months. And it was really opened with a lot of fanfare. The Rams, as part of the marketing agreement they had with the Disney folks, and Walt Disney was a father-in-law of a Rams player. Rams players had free tickets to go anytime they wanted, so it was a way for them to market. So, you know, my older siblings were able to go all the time. We eventually moved to Anaheim, not too far from there, so got to watch the fireworks as kids, you know, in the backyard every night at 9 o'clock. But it became part of the landscape, and he was a dreamer, right, Walt Disney. So it kind of fit the landscape of Los Angeles quite nicely because it's a land filled with dreamers.
We're speaking with Jim Hock, and we're talking about his latest book, which is called Father on the Line, a memoir. It is a look back at the Los Angeles Rams of the 1950s, and in particular, Jim Hock's father, John Hock, who was a member of the offensive line of the Los Angeles Rams until his retirement in 1957. We should talk for a moment about the state of affairs in terms of professional football in the early 1950s. And I think for a lot of people who don't know the history of the game all that well, they might be shocked at some of the things you say about the state of affairs of the NFL in the 1950s. At one point in the book, you write, in 1953, the NFL was a sports afterthought. Only ice hockey might have mattered less than the NFL. It was just kind of hard to imagine a United States of America where there is something called the NFL, but hardly anybody is aware of it or cares about it the way we tend to really care about it now. Tell us more about just how obscure the NFL was at this point in time and the forces that were about to change that quite dramatically.
It's a great question. So in the 1950s, to take you back, I mean, you know, TV wasn't, you know, what it was today, and football is a television sport, so it wasn't until, you know, 1956 with the famous game against the 58 with the Colts and the Giants, where the championship game went to overtime, which kind of, you know, put it on the map in a national televised setting. But another piece of context, just Sports Illustrated at the time, which is obviously the biggest sports publication. Pro football had about one or two pages every week. Baseball had about 10. College football had about six or seven. Pro football was not what it was until that moment when people realized, wow, this is a really exciting game. We can see it. It's connective tissue through our televisions and from a national TV audience. And that's where Pete Rozelle in the early 60s really you know, was an innovator and dynamic in his thought about, okay, I'm going to take what I learned doing with the Rams and having our first local TV contract, and I'm going to take that national. And once that happened, the sport exploded, and it, you know, was a perfect sport for collision sport for television, but also you could see personalities and other things, you know, on your television as well.
By the way, in terms of tying the Rams to Los Angeles, you tell us about a woman on the city council of Los Angeles who played a really important role in the Rams becoming such a central part of Los Angeles. Tell our listeners about her.
Yeah, her name is Roz Wyman. She's actually a personal friend. She is, when I worked for Senator Dianne Feinstein from California, she's one of Dianne's closest friends. And Roz and I talked a lot about this because she's a big Dodgers fan. And I was like, you know, I asked her, I said, Roz, how did you become a Dodgers fan? Not being a naive, you know, at that point, I was a naive 20-something. And she then told me the story about how she and the mayor at the time, Los Angeles, did not have a baseball franchise. And they started talking to Walter O'Malley, the owner of the Dodgers, when they were then in Brooklyn. And no one in their right mind would have thought the Dodgers would have ever left Brooklyn for Los Angeles, you know, 3,000 miles away. It must have been a world away back then. And, you know, L.A. had this feeling of like, we are a second-tier city, and how do we become a first-tier city? And one of the ways that, and Roz was a very young 20-something city councilwoman at the time. She's super dynamic and hilarious and awesome. And she said, I'm going to take this as my project. And she has an amazing power of persuasion. And so she was able to convince the mayor and then, you know, the team of them convinced Walter O'Malley that they could have some land in L.A., right, just north of downtown, what's now called Chavez Ravine, and build this beautiful stadium, and the rest was history. But, yeah, I tell the story of how that happened and how it transpired and how close it was to not happening as well from first-person interview with Roz Wyman, who's just an amazing lady.
It's great to get to know her and to understand the crucial role that she played in the Rams coming to Los Angeles and having a happy home there for so many, many years. The Rams left Cleveland in 1946 and, of course, have mostly been in Los Angeles since, with a brief period. Well, it was 20 years, actually, you tell us, that they actually transplanted to St. Louis and now are back in Los Angeles. Well, it's time to focus on your dad, John Hock, and it must be an interesting experience to write about one's own father, and especially when your father is no longer with us. What kind of mantle of responsibility did that feel like in terms of painting this rich, detailed portrait of your father and trying to be as honest and accurate as possible? What did that feel like to be trying to do something like that, particularly writing about your own father?
Yeah, you know, Greg, it was a pleasure. It was an awesome experience. I had a great time doing it. It was fantastic to learn more about my dad. At the same time, too, I was writing it and struggling with you know, some of these questions of having a couple of conversations with my mom, and you know, you go into a mom son conversation and she wasn't directly answering questions. And so I talked to a friend of mine who's a writer, and so my co-author actually of the book, Michael Downs, who was terrific. I had him interview some of my siblings and my mom just because it could be more objective, and he could ask the questions that, you know, instead of getting, hey, you know that, what are you talking about, kind of thing. You know, it would be, you know, there are no dumb questions. So he was a great partner to work with this, you know, on this book together. And he helped mainly on helping me, you know, on the personal interviews. I did a lot of the interviews with my dad's buddies, but Michael kind of took my family, just because I did that as a strategy of just trying to make sure that I got, you know, the accurate accounts. And not that they wouldn't give you accurate accounts, they just give, you know, I wouldn't get as rich, probably, responses or as detailed, because, you know, as the youngest, they would be like, hey, you know that, kind of thing. But it was just an absolute pleasure to learn more about my dad and my mom as well, because it's also a story about my mom and how they met in L.A. She grew up right around the Coliseum as well.
Your dad, of course, had Los Angeles as a hometown. He went away for college and then was drafted to play for the Chicago Cardinals. I think we've already mentioned that. And I think you told me before we went on the air, or reminded me that a certain coach by the name of Curly Lambeau was one of your dad's first coaches.
Yeah, so my dad went to Santa Clara University in Northern California. They don't have football anymore, but back then they were actually a pretty darn good football team. They won the, they just won the Orange Bowl. They had beat Bear Bryant's Kentucky team down in Miami, and it was just a huge upset. And so kind of put Santa Clara on the map in a lot of ways. But back then, you know, coaches didn't have film, didn't have the internet, so they would, you know, kind of go out and you want to see the merchandise, if you will. And so Curly Lambeau, who was, after he had retired from the Packers, went to coach the Chicago Cardinals and owned a piece of the franchise. He was the head coach. I believe he was in his early 70s at the time. He came to my dad's dorm room at Santa Clara University, which is a Jesuit Catholic school and all boys at that time. And Curly Lambeau sits on my dad's bed, and he's got one of those long extender cigarettes that you see in the movies in the 1950s. And my dad's story of meeting Curly Lambeau in his dorm room was he was most worried about Curly Lambeau dropping ashes on his bed because he was worried what the priests would say when they would come in and see the ashes on his, because they had to make sure their beds were made, believe it or not, back then. So that was his first experience with Curly Lambeau as coach, obviously, you know, the frozen tundra is named after him and just an iconic figure. But my dad was just a knucklehead 21-year-old and was more worried about what a priest was going to do to him rather than his future head coach.
Great story. Your dad plays for the Chicago Cardinals but then is drafted. Tell our listeners what your dad did in the military. This is intriguing
to
me.
He was drafted. A lot of players were drafted then to go play. He did the Army. He was drafted in the Army. But there was a USO kind of league at the time, football league, that my dad had played in to keep, you know, the guys entertained. And so he went back and forth from Korea and Japan for a little over a year and played in the Army Football League at that time. And a lot of his contemporaries did the same. And, you know, some of his friends then became coaches in those leagues as well. And so, you know, from Yokohama to other places, they were playing football in front of large crowds of GIs.
While he is in the military, he receives a letter from the Chicago Cardinals that he has been traded to Los Angeles. And so this is where his really serious career begins. Tell our listeners about this team that your dad was about to be part of, and in particular, the kind of successes that they had had in recent years, as well as some turbulence within the organization.
Yeah, so you can imagine, my dad grew up in Los Angeles. You know, he gets a letter saying he's no longer with the Cardinals. He's traded to LA. He was really excited on one hand. You know, obviously he made some friends in Chicago and really loved Chicago just in the short time he was there. But he was excited to go back home. And so, you know, the Rams were a franchise that was growing fast, had been there for about a decade from Cleveland, as you had mentioned. But their owner was an East Coast guy named Dan Reeves. He was, unfortunately, an alcoholic, so he was always kind of trying to push the envelope on a lot of things. They had a lot of changes in coaches, you know, through the 50s, just because they were, Dan Reeves was one of these owners that wanted to win at all costs. And so if you didn't kind of win a championship, you were kind of out the door. So there was kind of a revolving door there. So my dad kind of walked into that. And then shortly thereafter, the Rams had hired Sid Gilman, who's obviously a Hall of Famer now, went on to coach the Chargers and as I mentioned, kind of the architect of the modern passing game. But my dad was extremely excited to be back home in L.A. and frankly, within walking distance of his, you know, my grandparents' home.
One of the hallmarks of your book is that you get to profile for us a wide array of amazing players who were part of this organization. And I wonder how many of them were still around that you could directly speak to, and what kind of a difference that made in being able to really shape full, vibrant portraits of this team.
Yeah, it was really fun to talk to a lot of these folks. And like I said, I tried to talk not only to, you know, Rams that played with my dad, but people that played against my dad as well. That, you know, the NFL was a league of 12 teams, and it was kind of a smaller town, if you will, if you like to put it back then. So they all knew each other because they spent more time because of travel. You were in, you know, Chicago or Green Bay for a few days, or Milwaukee for a few days, so you got to know each other. They would, a lot of times, the players would go out and have, you know, beers opposing teams, you know, after the games together. So, you know, talking to these guys, you know, everyone from Frank Gifford to Andy Robustelli to others, it was really it gave me just, you know, personally, not more knowledge about my dad and the type of person he was from his contemporaries, but also just a richness for the book. And unfortunately, you know, some of them had passed that I'd wanted to talk to as well. And then, frankly, a number of them had, you know, developed some Alzheimer's, or, you know, what we now call CTE. And I always wonder if my dad had lived longer, if he would have had those same issues, you know, unfortunately, as well.
Right. It's interesting. You physically describe your dad as pretty imposing physically, although there were teammates on the line that were even bigger than your dad, but that your dad was a big man, a big football player. And yet, when we look at the photograph that is on the cover of the book, your dad does not look anything like the typical offensive lineman or defensive lineman of the current NFL. He looks much smaller by comparison, but apparently in his day, he was not a small man on the football field. That being said, you also give us some hints that maybe brute strength was not the totality of your father's gifts, but also the fact that he had been a wrestler and really had some agility and great balance, that's part of what made him as good a player as he was. Tell us more about what his most important attributes were as a player.
Yeah, he was, you know, 6'2.5", 245, 250 at his peak, which today that would barely be a fullback in the NFL. So it's a great question. You know, back then, you know, the offensive line, especially the offensive guards, were really kind of expected to be kind of athletic, and you'd pull a lot like they do today, but really with speed and agility and leverage, which of course, again, it is part of today, but you know, back then the tackles were much bigger, but the guards were, you know, expected to be athletes. Sid Gilman also wanted his guards to be particularly agile. I mentioned earlier, they would shuttle into plays back and forth. And so that took a lot of running back and forth. And as I said, my dad hated it, but you know, his attributes is he was tough as nails, and he just wouldn't quit on anything. And I even saw that, you know, later in life, even though his body was pretty banged up, when he kind of put his mind something, he would never stop. But yeah, that he was, you know, made the Olympic trials as a wrestler and just was a fantastic athlete in a lot of different ways.
You mentioned at one point that your dad and linemen like him typically made between $5,000 and $6,000 from their work in the NFL, I mean, per year or per season, which, of course, seems like a laughably modest amount of money now. Back then, even that was not a whole lot of money, and the typical football player in the NFL would also get some other kind of job to supplement his income for the remainder of the year. Remind me, did your father do that? Did he do other kinds of work besides his football play?
Yeah, he was a high school teacher in the off season.
Oh, that's right. Yes,
he taught George Washington Carver High School, taught history as well. But, you know, the context, Greg, the question you asked about the salaries, my mom was a third grade teacher and just made a little bit under my dad relatively, if you believe it or not, as an NFL lineman who made the Pro Bowl. And, he made the Pro Bowl once before he blew out his knee and had to retire, but got $500 from that, which was a huge amount of money to him, he and my mother. But he had promised my mom that he would buy a new furniture set. And, you know, my mom had passed away this past March, but she would always refer to that furniture set as the Pro Bowl set.
Hmm. You also mention in the chapter that tells us about training camp that no player earned any money. That's how the contracts were structured. No pay until you play. Practice didn't count. Neither did those half a dozen or more games called exhibitions, warm-ups that pit the Rams against other teams before the start of the real thing, the regular season. So what happened if a coach says a guy's not good enough and sends him home from training camp? Sorry, Charlie, no money for you. So it is such a different era in which these guys were playing. Fortunately, your dad was signed on to the Rams and became a critical part of the mix. As we've already touched on, this team was a mix of superstars like quarterback Norm Van Brocklin and others, and then all of these other sort of workhorse players like your dad, whose names were not up in lights, but were a quieter, essential part of this football operation. What is your sense of how those components fit together? I mean, did people like your dad feel appreciated by the organization? Did they feel appreciated by those superstar players who tended to generate the headlines? I mean, was this, in a sense, one big harmonious, if not always happy, family?
They got along. My parents always told stories about, you know, people like Norm Van Brocklin and Crazy Legs and absolutely adoring them as people. They were close to their wives, their girlfriends. So in a sense, it was a big family. They watched after each other's kids. My mom tells a story of, looking after the Disney, Ron Miller and Diane Disney's kids, as well. So it was a small, like I said, a small town. They had a small town mentality, but there wasn't a lot of tension, between the superstars and the regular folks like my dad. As a matter of fact, it was very, kind of a close-knit family. And even people like Bob Hope, the iconic comedian, was one of the part owners, and he was, he would come in the locker rooms after the games and treat everyone like, with respect and decency and dignity. And my parents always said that as well.
How do you reconcile the gentleness of your father with his work out on the football field? I mean, not that he was in any way a dirty player, but nevertheless, it's a persona that we don't often think of in terms of a hard-hitting player on a football team. That just doesn't always align with what our expectations or stereotypical ideas are about what it takes to be a great football player. How do you put that together in your mind?
Yeah, my dad was a really thoughtful guy in the sense of, like, he was a history major, had a really good sense of history and kind of where his part of, he played in the community. As well, he viewed football as like a fantastic game, but he always said leave it on the field, and so he would kind of do what he needed to do, and then he would come home, and he was the father of seven kids with four girls, and that'll humble you in a lot of different ways, and make you appreciate different personalities and what have you. But he went on to be a very successful executive in the transportation sector, but he kind of saw other people's perspectives. And another story that in the book that I touched on was, race in the 1950s was, was also part of the fabric of our society. The Rams were the most integrated team. He had five or six, depending on the year, black teammates, which, some teams like the Redskins, for example, didn't integrate until the 60s. But they would do exhibition games in the South before there were any franchises. Washington, D.C. was the most Southern franchise. There was no Cowboys or no Atlanta Falcons at the time. And my dad would, talk about seeing his friends who he loved, people like Tank Younger, the fullback, who's a good friend of my dad's, and, you know, show up in Birmingham, Alabama for an exhibition, and the plane would arrive and cars would roll up and take Tank and the other black players, and they wouldn't see them until they were on the field. They couldn't even share a locker room together. So at a young age, he had a tremendous perspective of kind of where his place was and how lucky he was, and the perspective on a lot of different issues that were going on.
You also tell us that in Los Angeles in this period, that when it came to the elite of Hollywood talent, I mean, people like an actor like Danny Kaye, you tell us no matter how famous or rich, those kind of folks were much more likely to chum around with a bunch of football players than with Los Angeles's wealthy elites. So in other words, it's within the realm of possibility that even a humble guy like your dad would be encountering and knowing some of the biggest names in Hollywood at that point in time.
Yeah, exactly. The Hollywood community embraced the team, and you know, whether that was because, you know, Walt Disney was a father-in-law of a player and Bob Hope was an owner, but there were other folks involved and around the team, and the Coliseum, where it sits in the city, is really right in the center. So it was kind of a place to be, and the Rams were, you know, the highest attended team in the 50s, you know, regularly selling 80,000-90,000 people in the stands. So it was a kind of a see and be seen event to be at a Rams game in the 1950s, kind of like being at a Laker game in the 1980s in Showtime with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Magic Johnson. Kind of that same kind of dynamic, obviously at a not a national television level yet, but in a city level, it was what everyone talked about.
Right. You write at one point, for the movies, an industry based on faked sets and faked deaths and faked love, football players offered a sense of bruising physical reality to counter Hollywood's obvious artifice. A cameo from a handsome guy who really did get tackled, who really did suffer bruises and sprains, gave the movies grit and toughness. In just a minute or so, I'm afraid, can you say a quick word about the fact that your father's football career came to a rather sudden and quick end in 1957 because of injuries? How painful was that for your dad? I mean, besides the physical pain that was part of his situation.
Yeah, football was his life. So it was, you know, obviously he was, you know, young married guy with a couple kids, and his knees just gave out. He massive knee injury, and surgery was different in the 1950s. Obviously, he couldn't do it anymore. He'd constantly kind of battled, you know, having tough knees. He also was a guy who could put things in perspective, and he thought about coaching. Afterwards, was offered a couple jobs in different NFL franchises, and he decided, no, I'm going to go into business, and kind of moved quickly on. Always stayed around it through his friends, but he never sounded bitter about how it ended, even though it took quite a toll on his body. And he was just kind of an optimistic, really optimistic guy.
Well, a great guy that we really get to know in the pages of your wonderful book. And obviously he was a wonderful man, a wonderful father, and cheered you on in your own football exploits. And, of course, is the inspiration for this terrific book called Father on the Line, a memoir published by Rare Bird Books. And the author, Jim Hock. Jim Hock, it's been great to speak with you. I loved your book. There is so much more in it that we did not get to even touch on today. But I hope people will seek out the book and be transported back to the 50s and to the to this colorful and wonderful period in the history of the LA Rams. I don't think you even have to be a football fan to enjoy this book a great deal. Thank you for giving it to the world, and thanks for being part of the morning show today.
Greg, thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Nan Calvert pays her monthly visit to the program, and with her will be Megan Severson, Executive Director of Wisconsin Environment, a powerful advocacy group on behalf of a variety of environmental issues and concerns for the state. And on Friday, Beth Bender and Pasquale Lorino from the Racine Symphony will be talking about the Racine Symphony, a marvelous project of performing Antonio Vivaldi's Four Seasons, and they are sharing with the public their performance of the Autumn Concerto this Saturday night. We'll be talking to them on Friday. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we remind you that you can subscribe to the Morning Show podcast and hear a different Morning Show 7 days a week. It's available on Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, all the major platforms. Be sure to look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.